From the studios of WBAA Public Radio in West Lafayette, this is Indiana Public Broadcasting's monthly conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. We appreciate you joining us on the show this month. And if ever you've got a question you'd like to get on this program, you can email that to news@wbaa.org or tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. Speaking of Twitter, I've seen you out and about riding around on your motorcycle trying to enjoy the summer, it looks like.
Right. The group here, we have a very excellent social media group here at Purdue, and they're always hounding me to tweet things more often. I'm not very good boy about that. But, yes, when I think of it, and this weekend I rode the bike first to church and then off on a ride with some good friends and wound up in a great diner I thought people should know about near Frankfurt. The Country Pride Cafe. I recommend it to all of you who are looking for a good, affordable breakfast.
When it comes to being active on social media, how do you think about that? Because it tends to be a very personal thing for a lot of people, but you, of course, have a very public face in your job. How do you balance those two things in the way you interact with social media?
Yeah, to me, it's a chore and it's scary. And again, I know I'm letting down our side a lot because I don't do it more often, but I just find it, first of all, when I remind myself it's been a few days, you better send something, then I try to put it together, but it's not something that comes naturally. I always say, hey, I don't really lead that interesting a life, don't really think people want to know what I'm buying at the grocery store and the way some people treat it. And then secondly, I say it's scary. I try to proof those things 2 and 3 times, make sure that the machine didn't misspell something or misconstrue some word as I typed it, make sure that there's nothing in there that someone could misunderstand. And the combination of my laziness and my caution about content leads to my doing far fewer of them than I know our people wish I would. But for some reason, there are, I don't know, 19,000 people out there who supposedly see these things. And so I'll try to be – that's a good resolution for the year ahead. I'll try to be a little more assiduous about my tweeting.
Do you do all of the tweeting, or does anybody ever tweet from your account?
I do it. I think maybe once or twice there was some sort of announcement. I was just too busy, and they proposed something and ran it by me. But no, usually I do it. I just I regret to say I don't do it as often as I probably should.
There are a lot of pictures of you with cute grandkids at sporting events and things like that.
Once in a while.
Fraternity, sorority dinners, things like that.
Right. I like to highlight things that happen on campus or people who come to visit. And sometimes that reminds me, I'll say to students, hey, let's take a picture. You could be tweet material.
Okay. By the way, if you want to tweet a question for Mitch Daniels, you can do that at WBAA News on Twitter. Also email those questions to news@wbaa.org. Well, the Indiana Historical Society has announced it plans to name you a living legend at a ceremony next month. You're already shaking your head, and I'm not even through the question. What is your reaction to that?
It's a very nice thing, of course. And I don't know what their criteria are, but I was touched to be asked and invited. It's important now. I have a new goal. I have to live till the dinner because you can't be honored if you're not still extant. So another good reason to practice good preventive health for another month or so. I'm a big supporter of the Historical Society. Appreciate their work to preserve and Indiana history and spread it. A knowledge of it, and so happy to take part in anything they're doing. And of course, it's a very nice thing. I'm either the first or maybe second person from public life. I mean, I've led multiple lives, but they've not had a lot of people so far who were spent time in elected office. So it was nice to be noticed.
Have you begun thinking about how the state is going to remember you about? people would, I guess, call it a legacy. Are you thinking about the curating the way Mitch Daniels is remembered?
No, I have a lot of stuff which the Purdue Library asked for, and that was a convenient place to send things. So we have a huge archive. Ours was the first state administration in the digital era. And so instead of lots of files and maybe microfilm and stuff, there's just an enormous amount of videotape and a reasonably complete record of things that happened. And so that's all placed with the Purdue Library, and I'm happy that it'll have a home. I don't know if anybody will ever want to look at it or not. The other answer to your question, Stan, is here's what I do think about a lot. It's not about me. I said over and over and over, it was the theme of a variety of speeches, and the second inaugural speech I gave, was short as it was entirely devoted to this. If there's a lingering memory or effect of our years, I've always said I wanted it to be that we became a state of higher expectations, that we were an innovative state. We were trying new things. We were always on our front foot and acting. Ours, whether people agreed or didn't, I don't know anybody who did not see our administration as a very active and vigorous time. We were doing big things every chance we got. And I always hope, continue to hope, that will be the ongoing mentality of our state. Never again to settle, as history says we always did, for good enough, middle of the pack, let somebody else try it first. And so that's what I hope. I hope that 10 or 20 years from now, if I'm still around to watch, that you'll see Indiana being a vanguard state, whatever that means in a different era.
Well, so it sounds like you really do care about what your legacy is.
Well, I think any job you do, you want there to be some lasting effect. Now, there are plenty of things that I know will be there. We built roads like nobody in the country. And whether it's the 231 bypass here or hundreds of other roads and bridges that we built or rebuilt, they're going to be there for a long time. We conserve more land. Wetlands and forests and natural land by far than all preceding administrations, and that'll be there. I don't see that getting reversed. But many of the other things we did with regard to a better economic climate, educational reform, people might change their mind. The property tax reductions, which we kept constitutionally, will be hard for people to reverse. That'll probably be there. But apart from all that, I always said that more than any one category of activity, what I hoped was that, again, we would adopt a new mentality of activism and innovation and forward thinking in our state, whether regardless of party, regardless of the personalities of whoever leads us.
I want to move on to a more somber topic. I wanted to talk to you a little bit about, since we're on a university campus, whether the Stanford rape case has changed the way Purdue is looking at sexual assault and those involved, including whether you're looking at all at changing the way that students are taught about this behavior, taught about how to avoid it, taught about the consequences of engaging in it. Has this caused any sort of reexamination here on campus?
Didn't need to. It'd be hard to do more than we do now, starting with Boiler Gold Rush in just 2 months. There are multiple modules then, and then we try to reinforce it throughout the school year. We won't tolerate sexual harassment, let alone assault on this campus. You know, Stanford's really about the criminal justice system. What has inflamed so many people is a decision a judge made, not any activity that not so much a activity that happened on Stanford's campus, although some people think they haven't done as much as they should have to build a preventive culture. So we work on this all the time, again, we start before Boiler Gold Rush. I send a letter to the incoming freshman that mentions very clearly that we have high standards of conduct here. And obviously this is a a principal category. So we'll keep working on it. The goal is zero. Nobody will ever get the zero in communities as large as a university as we are. But we're determined to prevent it and to deal harshly with it if and when it happens.
You mentioned engaging incoming freshmen, and on the various universities where I've worked and studied, then that is a fairly common thing. That is definitely something that's addressed in freshman orientation. But I find that the messaging tends to trail off as you get to be sophomore, junior, senior. You talked about trying to reinforce it through the year. How do you reinforce it to upper class students?
Yeah, we communicate regularly with our students, students and faculty for that matter, asked to take little quizzes, sort of surveys, which test their understanding, probably more than that, just resensitize them to the importance of this. And so we'll keep looking for ways to drive it down. A lot of student groups, including our student governments, have been effective partners in this. Frankly, what students say to each other may be more effective than what the university as an institution tries to communicate to them. So we've had lots and lots of good programs and student organizations who have made elimination of such activity a part of their own social service. There's a lot that has been done about bystander behavior and about...
Which, of course, was so important in the Stanford case,
yes,
as well.
Yes, and about proper response and care for those who have been victimized.
What is the judicial process like for somebody who is both accused of sexual assault or someone who is the accuser? How does Purdue make sure to treat both sides of that equation with the appropriate care?
Yeah, that's a very important question because, you know, there have been many abuses on the other side in which people have been wrongly accused, falsely accused, and didn't have any chance to defend themselves and had their lives ruined in a different way. So you have to... So I think our process, and we look at it all the time, but I think we've got a great leader of our process in Dr. Elisa Rolick. She tries to move things swiftly and surely. We're very decisive in dealing with people who have done something wrong, but try to make sure that it's fair also and that we don't have injustice done to innocent people.
Is there a way to get this message out, particularly to the young men on campus? And I don't want to stereotype, but let's face facts here, that the majority of those people accused are men, especially in college campus settings. And so is there a way to work through fraternities or work through other organizations that tend to be male-dominated to say, hey, guys, we need to reinforce it with you specifically?
I think that is where the emphasis is. You know, only, one in six or seven of our students is a member of a fraternity, for instance. But when I'm around those folks, I'm always talking about them. Actually, I think we have to hold them to higher standards of conduct, or they have to hold themselves to higher standards, and I usually mention that. You know, coming out of last year, I guess, as we were reviewing our activities here, the point was made to us by students rather forcefully, don't forget male victims. Now, the perpetrator is very likely a male in those situations too. But that was something that we hadn't, I guess, taken into sufficient account, that sometimes the person being harassed or worse is another male. And that's equally, of course, unacceptable.
This is Indiana Public Broadcasting's Monthly Conversation with Purdue University President Mitch Daniels. I'm your host, Stan Jastrzebski. Thanks for listening to this show on your local public radio station. You can email questions to news@wbaa.org, or you can tweet your questions at WBAA News on Twitter. I came across a news story showing that the University of Georgia has hired, and in a relatively low-level capacity, a former Purdue professor who had been accused of sending a nude photo of himself to a teaching assistant. The TA in question then filed a claim, and the university apparently has settled with that person. I wanted to know when this case first came to your attention. Obviously, if it's in the media now, it's been at the attention of the university for some time before that, I would assume.
Well, I do ask to be kept informed. Fortunately, these kind of cases are rare, but they're, they're not zero. And I guess I knew about the charge, and I knew that the person involved had been dismissed. And I don't know anything about the Georgia situation. My understanding is, but I, you'd have to verify that after this came to light, that this person was terminated at Georgia also. But that's appropriate. There ought to be consequences for misdeeds of this kind.
I understand that there was a second person, a second faculty or staff member involved, as well as that person also been dismissed from Purdue?
Not in our employ anymore. I don't know the details of that.
Okay. How many types of cases or allegations of this type are made against faculty staff members in a given year, do you think?
Very few, but each one is noteworthy. I mean, it ought to be zero, of course. And it's really unfortunate any time it happens. Because we have a large graduate school, I know that in the surveys that we've done and just watching anecdotally, on those very rare occasions when something does arise, it often is in that context where faculty and graduate students are working in proximity.
Numerically speaking, too, it tends to be a lower student-to-teacher ratio in the graduate student ranks.
Absolutely. And the work may be in labs or, I don't know, in a more direct and personal environment. So, but these are generalizations. The bottom line remains we have a zero-tolerance policy. Fortunately, the instance is not high, certainly not as best I can tell any different than in higher ed in America generally, and we just have to keep working both to eliminate the conduct at the front end and when someone crosses a line, be forceful about the response.
We talked just a minute ago about how you talk to students about sexual misconduct. What do you do with faculty and staff? Because there's not, for instance, typically a boiler gold rush where you get everybody in a room and you say, hey, please don't do these sorts of things. It's a much more distributed conversation. How do you have that conversation, especially when something like this happens with your faculty and staff, which are thousands of people large?
You would like to think you don't have to. You don't have to with adults. But no, I mean, again, one way is that on a recurring basis, everyone has to take an online exam about this subject, and the questions aren't exactly stumpers, but they do remind about not only the unacceptability of the conduct, but one's responsibility if you see it or think you see it, and how you try to participate in assuring that we don't allow it to slip by.
There was a report that this most recent case cost the university something like $200,000 in a settlement. That is, of course, on top of whatever is paid in attorney fees and things like that. What does this kind of contact between students and faculty, if there is an inappropriate nature to it, what does it cost the university on a yearly basis? Do you have any sense of that?
I don't. And we probably have some insurance on the litigation side. But that's, you know, the dollars are not the point. This should never, ever, ever happen. Even to the point where someone has a reasonable fear or belief that it's happening. And so we don't know a better way other than constant reminders of responsibilities that we all share, and particularly those in positions of authority, and the deterrence that can come from dealing very swiftly and effectively with wrongdoers, as I believe we did in the case you're asking about.
Have the standards for what constitutes harassment changed in recent years? Because we've seen and read so much about how millennials, especially as they have become the student group that is most commonly in school now, have changed the way the rest of us communicate, for instance. And so this plus the 24/7 news cycle, I wonder if there has been a changing conversation about what is harassment versus what is sort of buddy-buddy type talk. And clearly a nude photo being sent to a TA is over the line. But I'm wondering, do you have to look differently at what is considered inappropriate behavior?
I think everybody does. I think things that people averted their gaze from before or accepted when they shouldn't no longer are seen as acceptable, and that's a good thing. And we aspire to be one of the places in America most free from such activity, and I hope that we are. You and I have discussed in other contexts things like alcohol and drug arrests, that the incidence at Purdue is dramatically lower than it appears to be at similarly sized and peer institutions. And I hope our goal ought to be that sort of difference can be found ultimately in this realm of sexual misbehavior.
I honestly don't know the answer to this. What is the rule for a relationship of any sort of romantic nature between a faculty and staff member and a student? Because I know that differs from campus to campus, university to university. What are Purdue's guidelines on such things? Assuming that there's nothing but quote-unquote appropriate contact between the two, is it possible for a student and a faculty or staff member to have a relationship?
Rules apart, I just would hope that our faculty realize it's just not something that should be engaged in. It's just wrong about in several ways, and I hope and trust that it's the incidence here is very minimal.
Well, I mean, I ask because you know of stories, I know of stories where this has happened at many, many universities in the past, and so it makes sense to think that Purdue, being a fairly common university in terms of its structure, it might happen here too.
It might, but let's hope that it rarely, if ever, does.
Just a few minutes left with Purdue President Mitch Daniels on this month's monthly conversation with him. Remember, send questions to news@wbaa.org or tweet them at WBAA News on Twitter. I wanted to spend a couple of minutes talking with you about the choice of speakers for the presidential lecture series, and you and I have talked about this as well. And I noticed that in just the past semester or a little beyond that, you've had George Will, who's a relatively conservative columnist for The Washington Post, John Schnatter, the founder of Papa John's Pizza, who, and I've looked this up, has given more than $120,000 to conservative political candidates in recent years, and then George Shultz, who was in the cabinet of a couple of different Republican presidents. You talked on last month's program about wanting to expand the diversity of thought, diversity of opinion, diversity of expression on this campus. Nonetheless, people might look at this and say, hey, you've had some pretty conservative folks several lectures in a row now.
Maybe we're just catching up. You didn't mention three Obama cabinet officers that I had before that. Mara Liasson from NPR, for instance. Frank Bruni from the New York Times. I think if you look at the whole group right now, at a minimum, it's balanced. And, of course, many of the speakers we've invited don't have any political profile at all. I just try to find people I think are interesting and will attract a crowd, which the people you named did, by the way, very large. I don't think anybody came to see John Schnatter because of any views he has, and I don't about public activity. They came because Papa John's is a very interesting story, and he's sort of a mini celebrity in his own right. There's a wall in our office with the posters of a little poster from each of the people who's spoken. If you just scan that wall, you'll see a little of everything in there. And if anything, you know, Arne Duncan, Ray Mabus, the Secretary of the Navy, Tom Vilsack, the Secretary of Agriculture, you know, they're right there. Three Obama top appointees, which who are all nice enough to come here. And I think we've spread a very diverse table so far, and just trying to have a little of everything. But again, I don't mind telling you, my first thought when we mull over who might we invite is, who will be most interesting to a large number of people? Doesn't do us any good to get anybody here if only a small number of from the campus community can will show up to enjoy it.
Well, we're on the subject of whether it's political or not. I wanted to get back also to a conversation we had last month about the changeover in leadership in the University Senate. And the guy who's coming in, Professor David Sanders, who teaches biology here, has been openly critical of you in a number of different contexts, and now he's going to be the head of the University Senate. What are you forecasting in terms of how you two are going to work together in the coming year?
I hope it's a positive relationship. We're meeting the day after this is being taped, as a matter of fact. It'll be the earliest I've ever met, by the way, with an incoming or a new Senate chair. Usually the first meeting happens when school resumes, so we'll see. But, you know, Professor Sanders is a busy guy. He's a multi-time Democratic candidate for public office, as you know.
And now holds office as a Democrat.
And finally won. So he's an elected, you know, I kid David, he ran for – he's twice the politician I am. He ran for office at least two times as many times as I did. So he'll but I want to know what his agenda will be, if any, and we'll look for things. We'll start by looking for things that we can work on in common. I'll give you one example. David's been I've raised with the Senate in the last year or two the issue of academic integrity, which is a problem across higher ed. People are beginning to see it's a much bigger problem than we might have thought. And when I talk to students and to faculty here, we've got some issues. And so I have raised this because we can't address this without faculty leadership. And they would really need to guide us about how we might ensure that no student's hard work is depreciated because the student in the next seat is getting a good grade by cheating. And David has been very forthright about it and has had some good ideas. I don't know if that'll be part of his plan for his year as chair, but maybe it is. And if so, I'm really ready to go to work in whatever direction he and the Senate think will make the most difference.
Well, there's a little bit of baggage here in just our last minute or so, because he's been critical of, among other things, and I went and made a list this morning, income share agreements, the Gallup-Purdue Index, your relationship with the Wall Street Journal, Purdue's free speech policies, cancellation of the Common Reading Program, and that's just a partial list. Mm-hmm. In 30 seconds, how do you get past what has been a long-standing set of disagreements between you two?
Well, you know, he's free to disagree. We're not changing our direction on those things because of his disagreement. But, you know, I've always said I'm way too lazy to carry grudges. I just forget these things after they're over, and I'll be looking with Professor Sanders, with whom I think I do have a fairly friendly relationship. See him at the gym frequently. And, you know, my goal will be to find common ground. And, you know, let past disagreements sit, and let's if we're going to have disagreements, maybe they're out in front of us somewhere.
All right. Well, thanks as always for your time. We'll do it again 30 days or so from now.
See you then.
This has been Indiana Public Broadcasting's Monthly Conversation with Mitch Daniels. Remember, you can find all of these shows archived at WBAA.org. I'm Stan Jastrzebski. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Major support for the Monthly Conversation with Mitch Daniels comes from Gaylor Electric. Gaylor provides electrical services from pre-construction design through project completion and a 24/7 service department. Information at gaylor.com. Support also comes from Purdue University Press, publishing global scholarship and popular regional work since 1960, and featuring Calculated Risk, The Supersonic Life and Times of Gus Grissom, available in June. More at thepress.purdue.edu.